In just a moment's time, I'm going to call up our New Testament scripture reader. But before I do that, just wanted to briefly introduce our guest speaker this morning. If you read the newsletter this week or saw our church Facebook post, you already know this. Sometimes we get to be a place of healing for people, and sometimes recovering from church wounds, and sometimes that even ends up being a pastor. And we have been blessed to be home to Pastor Josh and his wife Rudy for almost a year's time, and he's going to be just sharing some of his story with us this morning, and I'm super excited, and I hope that you are blessed by what he has to share. Actually, right now, let's just welcome him with a round of applause, and then I'm going to call up Katie Anderson. Come on up, Katie.
Our New Testament readings for this morning are taken from the letter to the Galatians and the Gospel of Luke. Hear now the word of the Lord. Galatians 3:23-29. Before the coming of this faith, we were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. So the law was our guardian until Christ came, that we may be justified by faith. Now that this faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. So in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Luke 8:26-39. They sailed to the region of Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him, and they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were so overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. The word of the Lord.
Good morning, Ecclesia. You can see I've exchanged the usual cargo pants for gym shorts. That might first appear to be me trying to be humble or something. But no, we're moving tomorrow, so these are the clothes I have left. As you heard, my name's Joshua Cox, and I've had brief conversations with a few of you, but most of you, I'm sure, have no clue who I am other than perhaps seeing me, my wife, and children in church. But that was very intentional on our part. I have gone through and am going through a season of healing. You see, I have been pastoring since 2010 in one way or another. Youth pastor, associate pastor, and most recently as lead pastor. My time as a part of Ecclesia came after an immensely painful church experience. At a time when I didn't know what the future would look like for my vocation or my family. Next Sunday, I will begin serving as pastor of Grace Mennonite Fellowship in Virginia. So, although I generally like to focus on a text, today's message will be much more of a testimony to the work that God has been doing in my life. As you may have read, it's kind of about how I went from Baptist to Anabaptist. I think I first need to give you a snapshot of how I was developing theologically going into this story. I come from a Southern Baptist background. In fact, I went to the church right across the street growing up, and my parents still go to that church, Athens Drive Baptist Church, literally right across the street. It was a wonderful experience, a wonderful place to be loved and to be shown the love of God, especially by the still current Pastor Tim. However, in undergrad, I was able to study Christianity by what's called the historical critical method and to run into many, many different ideas. One man who kept popping up was Dr. Stanley Hauerwas. He was invited to speak on two different occasions at my school. And one time, I was in a room with him and about 20 other people for nearly an hour of Q&A. And if you don't know who he is, like I didn't back then, he was once named Time Magazine's Best American Theologian. However, growing up the way I did, I did not care for him at the time because he cusses like a sailor. And so I thought, whatever he has to say can't be of much value to true Christ-likeness, since cussing is obviously not very Christ-like. Also, he used the theological jargon that was like way over my little undergraduate head, and he liked to talk about death. And I was like, who likes to talk about death? I didn't understand why my professors kept inviting him. A few years later in graduate school, I was forced to do a report on chapter 2 of his book, Resident Aliens. That chapter has changed the course of my life. It was at that time that I began to reconsider Christian involvement with violence and how Christians ought to relate to the quote-unquote secular political world, and maybe that the church should be an alternative future society living in the present as a witness to how all shall one day live. And if you're a Disney fan, I've heard it referred to as Epcot, Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. So there you go. Something that I found particularly compelling, though, was that we all know the very early church didn't agree on many different things, many, many different things, and they were hashing it out for a long time. However, they all unanimously, remarkably, we might even say miraculously, for the first 300 years of Christian history, agreed that Christians should never take up the sword. That includes Hippolytus, Cyprian, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, these are church fathers, all of them, all, anybody you want to look for in that time period. And of course, the moment that some start to believe differently in Christian history comes after they become one with the Roman Empire. Together, those ideas, and many more I saw as I explored, I thought should make us think that maybe, just maybe, Jesus meant what he said. That's the first thread. The second thread is a lot less scholarly and more experiential. I went to an elementary school that was a melting pot of different peoples. And my middle school was in downtown Raleigh, Moore Square. I went there the very first year it opened, long before the area was, we might say, gentrified. I was one of maybe 4 or 5 white students. All of my years since then, I've had best friends that were black. I also have 2 uncles that married black women. And because I believe middle school is the time where you really start exploring who you are and exploring music, I fell in love with rap. However, I love the art, not necessarily the content. I desperately searched for Christian rap, or at least something that was more thoughtful. My parents did too, by the way. Of course, most of the Christian rappers at the time were very corny and less skilled at the art than their secular counterparts, if we're being honest. So I started listening to what's called the Backpackers, the Talib Kweli's, Mos Def's, and Lupe Fiasco's became my favorite, and you've probably never heard of 2 out of 3 of those people, if any of them. Eventually, in high school, there was a slow bubble up of competent Christian rap, starting with the Cross Movement, but ultimately, it was when I picked up a CD by a guy named Trip Lee that I entered a new world. And here's the first line. I discovered the 116 Click, Lecrae, Trip Lee, Tadashi, and Sho Baraka. You might know that name, Lecrae, now. They were artistically more competent and authentic, along with being energized for Christ. They also laced their lyrics with theology, although even at that time, I was waiting for them to get out of their Calvinistic phase. I still deeply resonated with them. I met my current best friend because I was wearing one of their t-shirts. This, or that picture that was up there, is actually from later that same day. I say all this to say that because of Harawas, I was sent down the rabbit hole of studying Christian nonviolence. And because of different ties to the African American community that included my family, my schools, my best friend, and the 116 soundtrack in the background, I was changed as a pastor. I began teaching youth and children about Christian nonviolence in different ways or through conversations. And I started to teach them about various specifically racial justice issues and social justice issues as well. However, as an associate pastor of youth and children, you are kind of, if you've ever been in one of those spaces, you're kind of in your own little wing, off to the side, doing your own thing. So when I started at my first lead pastorate, I knew I would be teaching for everyone to see, and that would be a different thing. It was about this time when I was searching for my first lead pastorate, that I began to read a lot of books by a guy named N.T. Wright. This had a dramatic effect on my eschatology, in other words, my understanding of what will happen in the afterlife. I began to see that churches, especially in America, are largely of 2 different types. One overemphasizes individual holiness, or we might say conversion evangelism, and God's transcendence to the detriment of social justice in the here and now. The overemphasizes social justice here and now to the detriment, we might say, of individual holiness and God's transcendence. Another way to say it is the one emphasizes the kingdom to come, and one emphasizes the kingdom here and now. We might say those distinctions often have to do more with political parties these days rather than theology anyways, but corrective theology, I think, helps. Theology, after all, is the language we use to talk about and therefore understand God. And N.T. Wright's work is largely focused on helping us to see that the kingdom of God is already inaugurated because Christ has already been given all authority in heaven and on earth here and now, and yet still to be consummated. It is also still to come when Christ returns. It's not either or, one or the other. So now that I've given you this background, you'll better understand what happened when I started my first senior pastor position in February of 2020. At the beginning, everything was great. I knew that some people in this town might have a hard time understanding where I wanted to lead them, but they were excited about beginning together, and I was too. And I figured I had plenty of time. This was partly, I now realize, my arrogance, believing that I could pastor somewhere that I knew had many people who were far away from my own thinking. And let me say that I want to be careful as I begin telling this part of the story, and I believe as we all should be, not to demonize other people, right? After all, our call is to love even our enemies and to pray for them. So loving our Christian brothers and sisters we might disagree with is the very least we can do. And if we're really honest, there are beautiful things to be found even in the people that we find ourselves in conflict with. Every one of them, you know? They are made in God's image too. And I really mean that, and I hope you hear that before I tell the rest of my story. So as I started there, the first issue was that they only had a pianist. So I was leading the hymns with no musical talent, as my wife is laughing. The pianist was acting music minister as well, but I was barred from even attempting to hire a music minister, pianist, or organist, or even to ask someone else that might have some kind of musical inclination to direct the hymns. After mentioning these ideas, people in leadership would literally just act like I hadn't said anything, or somebody say, literally like that kind of thing, or just say something like, we've tried that before and it went badly. So from that point forward, I just led the hymns and did what I was told as far as the music went. I knew there was no chance at open and loving communication as far as that went, and I was too afraid of getting off on the wrong foot. Despite this, COVID began, and we closed our doors. We had drive-in church outside, and then I would preach again inside for a live stream. The people love my sermons, and I love teaching, and I don't say that to be egotistical, but instead to say it started off well, at least. I was also calling everyone and checking in on them, praying for them, and so on. I had a virtual Bible study going, and not to mention all of this on the technology side of things, at least from the virtual Bible study to the live stream, was run by me. Especially as it went on for months. In June, my deacons decided, against better judgment, to come back in the building. I was already worried about this, of course, but then protests began to erupt as another unarmed black man was killed. So I wondered how, at this church I had just started at, I might speak appropriately to this moment. Because of all that I've told you, I felt I knew I couldn't be silent. And because I had seen so many of my fellow Baptist ministers be silent on these issues, even though many of them in private conversation agreed with me because they feared contention. I saw clearly that their method of don't be divisive no matter what, even if it means not doing or teaching the right and true things, was very clearly not producing the kind of disciples we ought to be producing. And Dr. Martin Luther King kind of hints at that in his, well, strongly says that really in his letter to the Birmingham jail when he talks about the white moderate, doesn't he? And because I had seen how in this town that seemed like really going back in time, it was about a 50-50 population, and yet they operated in separate worlds. Black people went to one gas station and white people to another. And I saw how several of my older congregants had all black farmhands and nannies. And I'm not kidding about that. I was on my cell phone during this time asking my best friend what the right way to address this moment was, and my office phone rang. It was a young African-American college girl in the town, and she introduced herself and said that she was organizing a march for Black lives in our little town, and that it would be going right by our church. She had already signed up the police chief, the mayor, and the local NFL hero to speak at this event, and she asked if I would like to speak as well. And I said, yes, of course. She said, really? My mama told me to ask you, but I didn't think you'd say yes. She said this because, of course, they knew my church and the history of its people. So I arranged to meet with her and agreed to speak and hung up the phone. Then I thought, okay, now how do I tell the deacons? I knew they all loved the NFL hero, at least when he bought new supplies for the elementary school students and supported local organizations and threw fireworks like he would the next weekend, which of course they all went to. The mayor and the chief of police that were speaking were white too, so I thought there might be a slim chance. My trial sermon was also on one of our lectionary texts for today, Galatians 3:28, and it included a story about how my D-daddy came to repent and love my black aunts after not attending their weddings. So I thought they knew something of where I stood. And when I got to the meeting, I told them about the march, and immediately they were irate. One of them said, "You tell me you believe this stuff?" And another said, "I'm not racist, but that doesn't mean I have to let my children marry them." The deacon chair just yelled incoherently until I said his name and said as calmly as I could, "Do we come to Jesus to change or to stay the same?" And he, mid-rant, stopped with a yell of, "I don't know!" He said, "I don't know." And one of them said, "Well, we can't make you not do it." And then we left. And I was preparing my sermon for the following Sunday, and I started to cry because I knew what the reaction was probably going to be. And I don't cry. I gave a sermon that next Sunday on Acts 8, inviting everyone to join in loving their African-American family. I think it was called something like Speak Up and Get in the Chariot, something like that. And invited them as well to the march, and had my super awesome secretary print the march flyer in the bulletin. After the sermon, many people exited the sanctuary out of the side door, or they walked by me without saying anything. Only one elderly lady came up to me and said, "I think we needed to hear that." She is one of those people you meet who is more holy than you ever might hope to be. And she remains one of my dear friends to this day. In fact, I found that even though some of the elderly did have some racist ideas or language, they were not the most resistant. It was the middle-aged crowd. The young people loved it, which was comforting at the time, but ended up adding to the problem. When the day of the march came, only my youth pastor and his fiance came, perhaps out of obligation, as well as the school principal, again, perhaps out of obligation, and one other person. Everyone else was black and not from our church. I made friends with an African-American pastor in the community at that march, and we were planning great things together, but unfortunately, I only got to worship with his congregation one time before we moved. The next Sunday before service, an older man came into my office and shut the door. And he sat down and he said, "You know, we are doing just fine, Pastor, until we hit this bump in the road. I think if you just don't talk about this stuff anymore, we'll be all right." I said, "What?" Then I found out that he had a problem, of course, with the march and the related sermon. He then asked me to show him where what I was preaching was taught in the Bible. I said, well, there was a sermon last week on Acts 8, but other than that, the good Samaritan, Galatians, you know, so on. And then he confessed that he was struggling to love his own mixed grandchildren. And I was just stunned. I mean, didn't know what was going on exactly. I was then approached by someone who told me that their family was upset with me. So I called these people and listened to their complaints and explained my points. And they were each shocked that I called, maybe because they didn't know how I knew, or maybe because I cared enough to reconcile. And we did, at that point in time, for the most part, reconcile. Over the next year, things continued in a more positive way, at least on the surface. One person started to be concerned that their college-age children and other college-age church members were listening to my preaching. For this person, it was particularly my preaching on hell in Revelation and how I did that in, what this person might say is a non-traditional or non-violent way. I should say I only decided to preach on Revelation, because that's pretty bold. I only decided to preach on Revelation because many of my congregants were talking with friends about the rapture and the mark of the beast, as one local pastor of a very large church had said, the vaccine was the mark of the beast, and so many other things that still boggle my mind. But this person would text me their problems with the sermons, and I would do my best to answer them. And this happened multiple times, all the time, constant. And each time I would ask for an in-person meeting, each time it was declined. And it was eating away at me. Every sermon, you know, I finished a sermon, and I expected, like, an hour later to get a text. And it went over and over like that. And I didn't know at the time, but this person had been telling the middle-aged folks and the youth that my teachings were heretical, and this all came to a head again the next summer. As I mentioned earlier, I began to see the nonviolent teaching of Jesus as something we should, at the very least, take seriously. I also saw how our true kingdom allegiance was to the kingdom of God, and how at the crux of the Christian story, we have a people of one nation, Israel, who expected a Messiah like David to be the new warrior, you know, to go and kill the enemy nations and to bring back the glory days. But instead, we have a God who came instead as a Messiah like David, but in the way that he was a shepherd. He came to tend to his sheep and to die for the other quote-unquote, enemy nations, so that they could be a part of the one true nation, the new flock. And I began to see how nationalism was overtaking part of the church at large anytime I looked at the news, and how it was so married to some strands of Christian faith that it became a serious, dangerous idol. I knew, but I didn't know how much of an idol that was for my church. The previous July 4th Sunday, we had been out of church again. No need for decorations. This time in 2021, however, we were back in church. As I also mentioned before, I had little discussion with the pianist about worship planning or anything serious. So I looked at the bulletin on Friday and saw that the hymns had been replaced by all patriotic songs, like the Star Spangled Banner, you know, for example. And when I went in the sanctuary, there had been 8 massive armed forces flags hung from the rafters. My grandfather served in World War II and the Korean War. My cousin died in Iraq. Many of the youth that I have mentored have served. I have a friend who works at the Pentagon. But if we're singing all our songs to America and transforming the place of worship into a celebration of America, instead of worshiping the God of the one true nation, which of course includes all nations, then who are we really worshiping? And I know many of you know that already. We are about to 1 Samuel 8 in our series on 1 Samuel, where the people demand a king like all of the other nations instead of accepting God as king. So I looked at that text and looked at God and I looked at that. I knew the message that I ought to prepare, that I felt like God was telling me to prepare. I saw again that the church at large was not producing the kind of disciples that I thought we should be producing, and that simply saying nothing or saying something that was very diluted was not working. But I knew again the probable immense pain to come afterward, and so I cried again for the second time, and again, I don't cry. I gave the sermon to a similar reaction as the previous summer. Only this time, it was more serious. Luckily, we had planned vacation for the next week, but when we got back, hardly anyone spoke to me on Sunday. And if they did, it was extremely brief and awkward. Some people weren't there who were always there, and I noticed at least one person left after the choir special. No one, absolutely no one, addressed it out front with me. I thought with, you know, reaching out to some of them with the previous issue and reconciling that folks would at least let me know when they're upset. That's the hardest part of pastoring. You know, people come and go, and people whose relatives you've buried will get upset and will just leave instead of talking to you about it. At the deacons' meeting, I found out, of course, that they were all upset and they did not agree in the least bit. I said that I could not do a service that was so nationalistic again and offered to meet in the middle, but nothing was to be heard of it. So I resigned. Because I said, if I'm keeping people from worshiping Jesus, and there is no moving the needle on this issue, then in order not to compromise my own integrity, let me step out of the way. And that was a hard thing for me because I had been so excited about my first lead pastor position, all these things. I left just a few weeks after that, and it was awful. I had, as I said, appreciated many beautiful things about so many people, and even some of the ones that were staunch opponents in these moments have been great friends in other moments. And I do mean that. I would later think, I wonder if they felt the same way. I had presided over something like 10 funerals, to give you an idea, in the short year and a half there. I had made connections through prayer, visits, Bible study, overcoming COVID obstacles together. I felt like I had lost a bunch of friends and I had lost a piece of myself. I had failed at my first lead pastorate. Worst of all, I had failed my family. We immediately moved in with my parents who were gracious enough to take us in. But when I sat down to the computer to look for a job, the only thing I was qualified for, the only thing I felt drawn toward was pastoring. And I received something like 5 offers to go and pastor other Baptist churches. But there was so much fear of hurting another congregation, fear of hurting my family. I knew whatever I did going forward, I didn't want to do that again. I still knew I wanted to pastor, but I didn't know when, where, or how to do that while keeping my integrity and while making the disciples we ought to be making, and while also not hurting anyone else. So I took a job as a substitute teacher and then a secretary for the time being, both very low pay. And while I did those things, I spent the months trying to be a good husband, trying to be a good father, and trying to reflect. I knew wherever I wanted to go, it wasn't the same denomination. I wanted to serve somewhere where I'd have at least somewhat similar convictions to what the denomination's doctrine was. When I reflected on the trajectory of my own theological development, I realized that Stanley Hauerwas was heavily influenced by Mennonites, some of who I had also read. And so I went where anyone else would go, to the internet. I didn't know any Mennonites personally. I had only read some of their works. I was following some online, though, on a dummy account. I don't have any real presence on Facebook or anywhere else, and that has saved me a world of trouble. one minnow, as we call them, minnow for short, Mennonites, one minnow pastor posted that he was taking prayer concerns. So I DM'd him a brief version of my story and asked for prayer. He said he would pray for me and that I at least sounded minnow-ish. He wanted me to move to Nebraska and serve a church near to him. And my wife said, Nebraska? So there went that option. But he did tell me a little about the Mennonite Church USA and how it is that someone might become a Mennonite pastor, and confirmed that they didn't use horse and buggies. So I went through the steps of contacting the right people and filling out the right forms and waited and waited. One church seemed like a fit and they were close by, but we couldn't work it out financially. So we waited again and began to talk to another church in early January. During this time, I continued to reflect and I read a lot. There were many times, many, many times, where in my parents' house with three of us sleeping in each room, working in ISS as a substitute teacher, working my way outside of my comfort zone as a secretary, waiting and waiting and waiting some more, there were many times when I didn't think it would work out. Like Elijah, I wondered after I left that last church if there was anyone who wanted to follow God in the way that I thought he was asking for us to follow him. Of course, now I see clearly that there were some even there at the old church who were. Along the way, I met Curtis and then CJ, and they very kindly sat and listened and prayed and encouraged me. We began to come to your church and to worship and seek quietly with you in the background, and that encouraged us. I met with my old campus minister, my old professors, and they encouraged me. I became part of a clergy fellows group, and we shared our stories and encouraged each other. I began to jump into the Mennonite faith, and that tradition encouraged me. My parents encouraged me, my wife encouraged me, my kids encouraged me. And I remembered that I was not alone. I remembered that there are many, many children of Yahweh all trying to figure it out. That there are great traditions of Christians who have been doing all the things I thought Christians should do, and many things I still haven't discovered that we might should do as well, long before I was born. I found that when I was looking for him to move in dramatic ways, God was there instead, in these still small meetings and reflections, much like he was with Elijah. C.S. Lewis describes Christians as a family living in a large house together. And he says, when you have reached your own room, be kind to those who have chosen different doors and to those who are still in the hall. If they are wrong, they need your prayers all the more. And if they are your enemies, then you are under orders to pray for them. It's one of the rules common to the house. My dad moved from the Catholic room of this proverbial house to the Baptist room. When reading about and jumping into Mennonite tradition, I discovered that us Baptists had largely come from Anabaptists, which is kind of the umbrella that Mennonites fall under, and that we are particularly connected through the Mennonite branch of the Anabaptists. It was like in the Disney movie Moana, where Moana feels a strange, deep connection with the ocean for an unknown reason. And then she discovers in a hidden cave that her ancestors were voyagers, and a light bulb goes off and she just starts running around excited and yelling out loud to herself, "We're voyagers! We were voyagers!" That's how I felt more and more as I read about how the Anabaptists, too, had seen that the early church were pacifists and realized that an important part of the Christian witness had been lost. I read about how they had an integrated sense of personal holiness, God's transcendence, and social justice. How they don't have an altar call, but instead share prayer concerns and reflect on the sermon and the service afterward, because they are committed not simply to an emotional response, but to a deep discipleship. It was from Anabaptists that the best part of Baptists, in my opinion, had come, such as believers' baptism and separation of church and state. So many of my questions had been answered reassuringly. However, my questions that linger on this Father's Day are, what does it mean to be a good father? Did I make choices that harmed my children's childhood, that harmed my wife's life and my parents' life? Did I pastor in a way that was bound to be divisive? How do we produce the kind of disciples that I think Yahweh wants us to produce? How do we be sure that the name of Christ rings with the rhetoric of peace and the beauty of truth? I don't know that we can ever be sure, but I do know that I see a different part of that beauty of Christ, who is the light, reflected each time I turn the kaleidoscope of Christian traditions. And it is only as we are held together as a unified body that we have a complete picture of Jesus. And that gives me courage to try again. Thank you.